Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to episode 1001 of the Tennis Podcast. Don't worry, I won't number every episode going forward. But since yesterday was our 1000th episode, I've done the maths, folks, and today is our 1001st episode. You find the three of us, myself, Catherine Whittaker, David Law, Matt Roberts, at Tennis Podcast Towers, London Edition. If there's some strange scratching noises in the background of this pod, it's because Billie Jean is on my lap and she's nibbling away at a bone. And why wouldn't she want to be doing that at 10 past midnight? Because that is the time, folks. No night sessions at Wimbledon, no night sessions to be seen. And yet here we are after what's been quite a fun day of tennis, I think. Is fun an adjective that we're all comfortable with to sum up today?
Yeah, I think so. We said that Tim van Rijthoven would make it fun. And he certainly did for a set,
and
anyway.
Isn't it great that we were extremely vague about what we meant by fun?
It was a very deliberate word choice.
There was just a little bit of Lucas Rossell from 10 years ago. Can you believe that's 10 years ago?
Gosh.
About that set. The difference was that he couldn't keep it up, but also Djokovic didn't let him keep it up. You know, I think Djokovic 2022 is just a very different proposition to Nadal 2012, as it would have been, but it has been a fun day. I do think there's been a lot to enjoy today.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to start with Elena Ostapenko, which is where all of our days started today, because that is an energy that will live with me for a long time. But since we've gone down a Tim van Rijthoven avenue, should we stay down that avenue? Because that is what we've most recently watched. It managed to finish just inside the Wimbledon curfew of 11 p.m. thanks to Novak Djokovic's utter brilliance. But before Novak Djokovic's utter brilliance, it was really good, vague fun for quite a while. Tim van Rijthoven playing in his first ever Grand Slam main draw up against Novak Djokovic, who, with that win tonight, makes it 25 in a row unbeaten at Wimbledon. He's obviously going for a fourth consecutive title this year. I mean, yeah, for those, I mean, we should talk mostly about the second set, shouldn't we? Because that was the one that was, quote, fun. And it really, really was. And I love the Lucas Rossell comparison, David, because I was sitting there listening to the sound of the ball off the racket under the roof on centre court. And it was reminding me of something, and it was Lucas Rossell. And I know a large part of those acoustics are the roof being closed. That somehow the thunder crack of a ball off the racket is exaggerated and amplified. But still, it was Rossell-esque. I've seen a little bit of Tim van Rijthoven when he did what he did in Sogenbosch. I found some footage of it and watched that. And I saw a little bit of him a couple of rounds ago. I didn't know he could hit the ball like he did tonight. That took my breath away.
Yeah, it's a really clean strike, and he's a big, strapping guy. I mean, he's 6'2", but he's broad, and he goes for it. And I think what happens under the roof is, because it's under lights, you feel like you're out for a night out. It's a different feel to the daytime. And the crowd are all up for a night out at that point, and a bit of drama. And he was he knew that his normal game is not going to get it done against Novak Djokovic. I don't even know what his normal game is, but I know that it ain't that, because he was having to push the limits. He was having to redline his game, and for a set, he not only redlined it, but it worked. And what was really impressive is that after he'd broken and Djokovic decided enough, lockdown, stop him playing, make him play horrible shots, make him face break points, he stood up to the break points and still got over the line in that second set. I mean, it did feel like Djokovic took that personally, because then he won about 10 of the next 11 games. But even so, it was a mightily impressive performance from Raitovin, because he didn't freeze, it could have been one of those embarrassing one-sided landslides, and it wasn't. He's got a game. I compared him in commentary to Aslan Karatsev in terms of the way he just has come on the scene and actually has what looks like a sort of ready-to-go game. The backhand is a bit erratic, and that can be picked on, but only by players like Djokovic, or really, you know, top players.
It was erratic tonight because he was at the absolute limits of what he was capable of, wasn't he? As you said, he was having to absolutely just redline it, which, generally speaking, is unsustainable for anybody but the absolute best in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I found it was particularly impressive how he started redlining a set in. You know, it was like, it was possible that he came out brilliantly and would have troubled Djokovic and it sort of tailed off. But what happened was that he came out and his stuff wasn't really working. Djokovic was too good for him.
Immediately broken, three love down, you're thinking, uh-oh.
Yeah, this is going to be one-way traffic probably. And yet he found an extra gear, and I thought that was really impressive. But my takeaway ultimately was just how damn good Novak Djokovic is. I mean, that was a sticky situation there. I didn't ever think he was going to lose, but I thought he might be left over having to finish it off tomorrow, because he had about 80 minutes to win the last two sets before the 11 p.m. curfew.
He was probably thinking, bloody Cliff Richard, at that point.
Poor Cliff.
He wasn't the only
because
one.
Because, of course, the schedule on centre court started later today, or the tennis schedule on centre court started later today, because they had an incredible ceremony to mark 100 years of centre court. And it was, they had so many past champions, and they announced them out onto court brilliantly. They had those doors at the back of the court that are new this year, that were opening stars in their eyes style, to reveal one champion after another. And there they all were, standing next to one another, with the big reveal of Roger Federer at the end. And of course, they did it in order of how many titles they'd won. And so Roger Federer ended up being the last with 8, and it should have been Martina Navratilova following him with obviously the record of 9, but she's contracted COVID, and I'm gutted for her that she wasn't able to be there today, because I know how much that would have meant to her, and what it would have meant to the ceremony to have, you know, the all-time great there. But anyway, it was wonderful. It was beautifully done in the way that sort of only Wimbledon can do that kind of pomp and ceremony. There was a portion of time before that where there was quite a lot of Cliff Richard singing, and I'm not going to delve too deep in my feelings about this, because I have already insulted a British legend of the musical world on this podcast during the last week or so. But I feel like the ceremony could have been streamlined somewhat.
Yeah, they always can, and they're always going to overrun, and it overran a bit. And inevitably that feeds into the tennis, and that's the problem with it.
And they didn't move the start time of centre court back at all to allow for the... I mean, I think the ceremony itself lasted 45 minutes, but with sort of stuff either side. You know, we're talking about minimum hour delay, really, for the players getting out. So that's 2:30 start time for, you know, what turned out to be three pretty meaty matches. I think they were incredibly lucky to get it done before curfew. Tonight.
Yeah, well, they had 20 minutes to spare in the end. So and they had
and that was Djokovic rattling through.
Yeah, proper efficiency from Djokovic, who had a vague knowledge of there being a curfew, but yeah,
it was like someone was standing courtside tapping their watch. Like, we'd really like to get this done, Novak. I'm sure you would as well.
But I did find the ceremony really uplifting and moving. Generally speaking, I missed the montages at the start, but when the players came out and they're all standing together, and then
incredibly
they played moving. The music as well, and that was yeah. lovely.
I will remember that for a long time, that yeah. Parade of Champions. I thought it was beautiful. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know, you had your one-time champions in there, like Angela Mortimer. It was brilliant to see her, and she was chatting to Nadal. I'd love to know what they were talking about. And then you had Venus Williams emerging, serving a look with the hair, the fit. It was...
What they had was Bjorn Borg. They had five-time champions, and they were obviously lining them up. They were coming out in quite quick succession, and the doors would open and then close, and the doors open to reveal Bjorn Borg as he's announced. But you can see the silhouette of Venus Williams behind him, the absolutely iconic silhouette of Venus Williams, and it was such an epic moment. And then Chris Evert comes out, and you know it was touch and go whether she'd even be able to make it to Wimbledon this year, because she's been having chemotherapy. And my goodness me, we wish Chrissy well. And I got really emotional seeing her come out onto court, and of course tears continued as Billie Jean King came out onto court, and there she is chatting away to John McEnroe and Sue Barker, and then John does his tribute to Sue Barker, which she handles with just the ultimate elegance. It was really quite something.
Yeah, it really was. And Federer gives the line that he hopes to be back at Wimbledon one more time. I mean, it was perfect, that whole thing. And that was probably my overwhelming take on the day. Yes, it was fun. But what I really felt today at Wimbledon was the sense of history. You know, it was the first ever scheduled play on Middle Sunday, so it was a historic day in itself. They were marking the 100 years of Centre Court. And then you just had people at Wimbledon who've made all the history, all those champions. You had people taking part who, you know, like Novak Djokovic, who are hoping to make even more history. And then we'll come on to a player who I think was a little bit intimidated by the history and kind of was pretty much open about that, and that was Carlos Alcaraz, saying he found playing on centre court, he didn't use the word intimidating, but that was pretty much what he was getting at. And he said he didn't handle it very well, and he talked about the essence of centre court and what it means in the game, and it was all a bit too much for him, and it can swallow you up. It's an amazing place.
You actually saw that even when he came out. I thought it would manifest itself in kind of uplifting him and energizing him and inspiring him. Actually, he was really poor for two sets. Jannik Sinner quietly was brilliant and actually stopped him playing and took over that match. He showed a lot there. I think it did show that Alcaraz was just... Ooh,
it not, bore a lot of similarities to the Zverev match in Paris, didn't it? You know, you texted the group, gosh, when Alcaraz is bad, he's very bad. And, I guess part of that is relative to our expectations of him. But when it goes off, it goes off quite spectacularly, doesn't it? And he's not the most demonstrative player, but you do know how he's feeling. And, you know, he was so frustrated out there, wasn't he? Just like he was in Paris. It was amazingly similar.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, even the pattern of the match, two very, very bad opening sets from him, gets it back in the third set with some absolutely spellbinding tennis in that tiebreak. I mean, the little half-volley winner that he hit in that tiebreak was, I think, the best... Well, maybe not as good as Marie Buzkova's backhand up the line, but otherwise the best shot I've seen all tournament. And then just didn't quite have enough in the fourth set. It was all very similar to the Zverev match. But what I felt is that watching Alcaraz this season in, you know, Miami and Madrid, it's blown my mind how in control of his game he seemed generally with all the options that he has. And yet you see a performance like this and the one against Zverev, And it, just as you said, when it goes off, it really goes off. He suddenly looks like he's not in control of that game, and he doesn't quite best know how to use his drop shot and how to deploy the forehand. He doesn't seem to quite have set patterns of play that he relies on. It's all a little bit all over the place, and he's trying to keep it under control, and he just couldn't quite today. Versus Sinner, who was awesome, who was completely in control of his game and really kind of overpowered Alcaraz. I mean, he's such a slight man, Sinner, and yet he's got such power on his strokes. And I think he took Alcaraz back with his power and with his timing. And he was in complete control of his emotions and of his game, Sinner, in a way that Alcaraz just wasn't quite today. It was quite a stark contrast, I
yeah,
felt.
It was. It was very striking. It does, not totally universally, but it does take longer for players with options to mature, doesn't it? To figure out their game and deploy it in a way that wins big tournaments. Ons Jabeur has talked about that. Now, I know there's a fitness element with Ons Jabeur and a belief element as well, but there's also figuring out how to use her incredibly massive tool bag. Even Roger Federer, it took him longer than people expected it to take him.
Yeah, definitely.
Whereas, you know, a Jannik Sinner, I mean, I'm not saying he's one-dimensional at all, but it's very clear what his game plan is, and that's going to be pretty similar. Every time he walks onto the court, no matter who he's playing, no matter what he's doing, he's drilling that forehand, he's trying to take it early, he's drilling the backhand, he's drilling his ground strokes. And yeah, some matches he'll try and play more into the opponent's forehand, and some he'll play more into the opponent's backhand. But by and large, he's doing what he does. And it makes sense to me. Thanks, Billie Jean. It makes sense to me. That's somebody playing the drinking game is having two shots as right now for a Billie Jean bark. It makes sense to me that it is brilliant and precocious as Alcaraz is. It might take him a bit of time.
Yeah, I think that's true. And he still looks like a foal to me, finding his legs, suddenly discovering they work at times, particularly on grass. You know, he didn't look comfortable out there, really. He didn't look like he knew what was going to happen next. Whereas Sinner did. For Sinner, it was all second nature. This is what you do on grass, which is interesting in as much as he'd never won a grass court match before this tournament. But he didn't look like that.
Mm.
Whereas if you said Alcaraz was in that position, you would believe that he was the one who had never won a grass court match before, because he wasn't playing grass court tennis. I mean, Sinner, okay, it may not be classic stuff, but his movement and his base and his foundation and his ability, his knowledge of when to go for a shot and when not to, there was a clear difference between the two of them. Even a spectacular winner I saw that Alcaraz hit down the line with the forehand, it was just a kind of all or nothing shot because he was so far out of court and he was going to overrun the ball. So he either picks out the postage stamp in the corner or he's lost the point, no matter what. There was much more in the way of combinations being played by Sinner in order to win points. And there were much more reliable patterns.
If there were a men's backhand list, I think Sinner would be on it.
But there isn't.
Not at the moment. I haven't got one. I think I tend to think more about women's backhands. I just think the forehand is such a dominant shot in men's tennis that the backhands stand out to me more in women's tennis.
Looking forward to you developing that list over the next 12 months.
I think I'm going to have to.
It's good to have goals. You can't have achieved everything already.
Quite.
There's a line from a book I love, a Dolly Alderton book, about she and a girlfriend, I think, are just discussing men, and one of them refers to a man in their life as not being very emotional. And the response to that is everybody's emotional. It's just some people process and deal with and express their emotions differently. And I do believe that is the case. I do believe Jannik Sinner has emotions. We just don't hear about or see them very
unless
much.
Unless he's in Italy.
Unless he's in Italy, yes.
And then he
of
comes
course.
Alive.
Only
comes
in Turin.
Alive. Yeah.
Only in Turin. He was asked to describe his emotions after the match, wasn't he, in the on-court interview, and
didn't go brilliantly.
Didn't go brilliantly.
What did he say?
Can't remember.
that good.
Yeah, it was underwhelming.
Okay.
Yeah. He's an understated guy, unless in Turin.
Mm.
But with this not at all understated game.
No, and honestly, his power takes me by surprise. I don't see it coming, the way he just suddenly can, you know, hit 100 mile an hour forehand, seemingly without changing that much, without throwing himself into the ball. It's such sweet timing. I think it's the first time I've watched him live. And anyway, I think he's now made quarterfinals at three different slams on three different surfaces, which is quite a big thing. And I was thinking, actually, you know, I think we're very, very excited about Alcaraz, and in a very obvious way, just because of what he's done this year. But actually, you know, Sinner, in a more understated way, has done similar things. Okay, he didn't do what Alcaraz did in Madrid and beat Djokovic and Nadal back to back like that, and he didn't end up winning Miami like Alcaraz did, but he reached the final as a teenager. He's reached quarterfinals of slams, which is as far as Alcaraz has gone. There's a little bit of a similarity in that I think they're both pretty humble, you know. They're both, I think Nadal would call them, healthy people, both of them. They both had this sort of father figure influence. For Sinner, it was Piatti, who he's obviously no longer with, and Alcaraz, it's Ferreira, who he is still with. So I'm excited about Sinner Alcaraz as a potential rivalry, to
Ooh,
be honest.
Said the R word.
I have.
Yes.
I have. I think their games match up nicely.
You could see it on all the surfaces.
Mm. Mm. Totally.
I'm here for that. Mm. Can Sinner challenge Djokovic in the next round, in the quarters?
I tell you, Djokovic looks amazing.
Yeah,
Djokovic looks the best he's looked at this stage of Wimbledon, to me. And I know it's recency and all the rest of it, but it's still how I feel watching him. And I know he lost a set today, but even that was a guy playing out of his mind. Djokovic's reaction times are so finely tuned at the moment, but with proper intent on shots. He's not just rallying for the sake of... He's not like extending rallies to 30 shots at all. He is going to make you pay, and he's going to do it quickly this year. And I don't know. Not sure how you stop him. Not sure how you stop him. And maybe Nadal could, if they got to the final. Obviously, Nadal's good enough. But Sinner... I think Sinner can put up a good fight, and if he plays well, he can put up a good fight, and I think he could win a set. I'd be surprised very surprised if he beat him. Very surprised.
The other men's quarterfinal that was decided today, or set up today, was Cameron Norrie against David Goffin. Norrie put in a world-class performance to beat Tommy Paul. Three sets, 6-4, 7-5, 6-4. It was... I know to say professional is damning with faint praise, isn't it? And we do so much of that with Cameron Norrie. But it was, wasn't it? It was just, you know, he cares about the occasion, obviously, but just processed and digested all of it and just went out there and played top 10 tennis.
I was interested to hear Leon Smith in our commentary when we were doing the Djokovic match. He said when he was courtside, he looked up the speed of Norrie's shots because he felt there was more on them than there had been throughout the rest of the tournament, and he found out that was the case. He'd come up amped, ready to go, and I think a lot of it is ticking that box of reaching
pressure's
the second
off.
Week. Mm. I've done that right
that
now.
That was the goal.
Next one. Mm. And he took it to Tommy Paul, and
that is very much his attitude in the macro, isn't it, as well? He's never satisfied. It's always the next thing. It's always the next goal. It's always the next thing to strive for. Never content, never satisfied. And that's what's got him to where he is.
Mm. Yeah, and I think it probably helped a little bit that he knows Tommy Paul very well. They practice together all the time.
Play doubles together a bit, didn't they?
Yeah, and I think he just felt very comfortable in that matchup. And as you said, he played the end of every set brilliantly. It was quite tight at times, and yet he just played the big points really well. It was just, yeah, I'm going to damn him with faint praise and say professional, but that's exactly what it was. It was such a job well done on a stage he'd never been at before. And yes, it helped that Tommy Paul was sort of similarly inexperienced there, but no, he just does what he does, and it's so good.
He lives down the road from me, from us where we are now, in Putney. I won't disclose his address, although in a conversation that ended up being far weirder and more awkward than I had planned, we were doing chit chat before our pre tournament interview in Queens, and I'd seen him post an Instagram put up an Instagram post from his flat, and I thought, oh, that's, I know where that view is. And so we were doing, you know, the awkward chit-chat while the cameraman establishes the shot and everything. And I sort of very weirdly blurted out, "Where do you live?" And then had to row back on it and try and make it less weird. Anyway, he handled it very well. And he does indeed live down the road. And he's cycling in to Wimbledon every day.
Good lad.
Yeah.
I walked in today.
Mm. He went for a run yesterday.
I walk in every day.
Yeah, you do, don't you?
Albeit closer, I guess.
The BBC have already done... They went early with their On Your Bike feature.
Did they?
With Cameron Norrie, yes.
Oh, good.
Yes.
They need some more as he progresses through
the
tournament.
I think it's quite a rich seam of content, isn't it? Cycling in every day. He will face David Goffin in the Wimbledon quarterfinals. Goffin beat Francis Tiafoe in an epic.
Longest match of the tournament so far.
Longest match of the tournament. A friend of mine described it to me earlier as a match that defied physics. 7-5 in the fifth for Goffin. That's the second slam this year that Goffin has knocked Tiafoe out of.
Doesn't Tiafoe know it?
With apologies to both mine and David's mum, fuck that guy, is what Tiafoe said in jest, or, you know, with a twinkle in his eye, about Goffin after the match. It was incredible.
It was a stunning match. Really high quality. You didn't know which way it was going to go. And this means a lot for David Goffin. It kind of reminds me a little bit of Marin Cilic's run at the French Open last month, in that I didn't think we were going to see this again.
I thought he was going to retire after COVID and the pandemic and lockdown and everything. He seemed so dispirited.
Yeah, I was looking at his record from March 2021 to March of this year. That's really not that long ago. 9 wins and 19 losses.
Included
a 7-match losing streak in there. Gee. He was really, really struggling. He had to qualify, I think, for Madrid this year. You know, David Goffin, who is... I think of him as an established top 20 player, you know, who occasionally gets himself in the top 10.
Bit of a Nishikori.
Yeah, like he's so talented and has been so consistent over the years. This last year has been... It's been the anomaly, really. It's been a dark time for him. And he turned it round at Davis Cup this year when he got some wins. And since then, he then won that title in Marrakesh. I think he's been playing a lot better. And he loves the grass. He reached the quarterfinals at Wimbledon the last time he played Wimbledon, which was 2019. And, yeah, it's really, really impressive from him as well.
And to win a match as physical as that one, I mean, you could practically see Tiafoe shaking from the lactic acid build up in his legs in that fifth set. It was extraordinary. And for David Goffin, you know, by far the older player coming through the injury situation. I mean, when would he have last played a match that long? Goodness knows when. But anyway, for him Tiafoe didn't fail physically. He didn't outlast him, Goffin, but to just be on an even footing physically is an incredible story, I think. Goffin, Norrie, for a Wimbledon semi-final.
Yeah, I mean, that you'd have to think if you were either one of them, great opportunity, because normally they're going to be running into one of the big four or five, aren't they, at that stage over the course of certainly Goffin's career. He would have had all sorts of matches like that. And for Norrie as a first-time quarter-finalist, I mean, I think Goffin is a sort of player that could end up beating him, but how big a deal is that 4 hours and 36 minutes? That's, you know, Norrie's just gone through in three sets and he can run all day. He could make that physical in a way that could determine the way it goes.
With his big lungs.
Yeah.
With his unusually big lungs.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I think you'd have to call Goffin Tiafoe the match of the day on either the men's or the women's side. But for me, Yelena Ostapenko and Tatiana Maria runs it close. Tatiana Maria, 34 years old, 103 in the world, recently come back from her second maternity leave, 1-3, 5-7, 7-5, 7-5. I say 1-3. What I should say is collected Yelena Ostapenko's mistakes in order to win through to Wimbledon quarterfinal, because that is how Ostapenko summed up the match.
She was lucky, lucky, lucky.
No way, really?
Well, she scored a lucky three different times in the press conference.
It was amazing.
Oh, my word.
Have you seen the clip of her leaving the court?
I saw the handshake, but I was too busy looking at Maria because I was on the commentary of that match point for Five Live. And whilst I'm looking at Tatiana Maria celebrating, I just start hearing booing.
Mm.
But I didn't know what was going on.
Yes, I just saw a tipped over chair.
Mm.
Oh.
It was a very poignant image. What had happened was Ostapenko had thrown her water bottle down in disgust as she was trudging off the court, and it had hit the chair, such was the force with which she had thrown it, and knocked the chair over in her wake.
You've got to really put your back into that, haven't you, to knock it over.
She was displeased.
But, I mean, it really did have everything as a match there.
Yeah.
Everything you could want. A lot of face from Ostapenko, drama.
I miss that face.
It was in the balance the whole way. Maria saved match points, didn't she? Sliced forehands. It was just
she was the baiting. Full package. She was baiting Ostapenko to go for it when it wasn't on. And she was doing it with these horrible little forehand slices and drifting it onto the baseline and then doing a short one. It would drive you bonkers. Mm. And that's the tactic. And she's such a clever player. I couldn't believe it when I started to read up on her story and find out that she'd switched from double-handed backhand to single-handed backhand during maternity leave the first time.
Yeah, during her first maternity leave, which was back in 2013. You know, she's got a 9-year-old daughter who's here with her. Both her daughters and her husband are here with her this tournament. And, of course, her 9-year-old daughter is old enough to to really take it all in and appreciate what her mum's doing.
Naomi Brody was telling me that her 9-year-old daughter Nyan coaches her. You know, starts telling her what she's supposed to be doing out there.
Yes, I think they play together every morning, like 8:30 in the morning. They're hitting on the indoor practice courts.
And she had the best results of her career the last time, the first time she came back from maternity leave. I think she broke the world's top 50 and reached a couple of finals. So this is what she does.
Mm.
She has a baby, comes back. I think she took 3 months off for her daughter that she had in 2021. And here she is, 34 years old. She's incredible and in incredible physical shape.
She's a great athlete and she's a great exponent of the game she has. She makes it work and makes it horrible for the opponents. I think one of the quotes she said in the WTA website interview I saw was, some people like to bungee jump, some people like me like to go and have a baby and then come back and play tennis and join the tour.
Different folks, different strokes.
Yeah.
She saved 2 match points, didn't she?
Yeah.
In the second set, hence the water bottle throwing from Ostapenko.
Ostapenko really is such a bizarre tennis player. There's no such thing as momentum with her, because okay, she can go on streaks and be unplayable. She's just as likely, after hitting a line-licking backhand, to double fault on the next point.
Mm.
You genuinely have absolutely no idea what's coming next.
In a rally, in a match, in her life.
Yeah.
She's great fun to watch.
Isn't she? Oh, I love
and listen to. And I mean, it was quite interesting. I read an article in The Guardian by Tamani Karyal, and he'd put her words from Birmingham to her. The ones where she said about America Marina, she didn't do anything, you know. It was all me, you know, all sort of thing. And she said, "Well, I don't see any points in coming in the press conference unless I'm going to tell you what I think." And I thought, yes, "Hallelujah, good for you."
But I also, I mean, the total inability to see that collecting her mistakes is a totally valid way to win a tennis match, like. Yes, Yelena, of course, if you made no mistakes, you would win every match. you hit lots and lots of winners. But yeah, you can sometimes make quite a lot of mistakes as well. So Tatiana Maria sets up a Wimbledon quarterfinal with fellow German Julia Niemeyer. She beat Heather Watson 6-2, 6-4. In the first match of the day on centre court, if you don't include Cliff Richard versus Catherine Whittaker. she looked so comfortable on centre court, didn't she, Niemeyer? It was her centre court debut. And yeah, she had weapons that Heather Watson doesn't have. They were very clear to see, power that Heather Watson doesn't have. But I thought the fact that Heather Watson had the centre court experience might be a factor today. And yet, it wasn't really. Niemeyer looked comfortable right from the off, and she can play, Niemeyer. She really can play. She's 22, which doesn't sound that old, but you might think, where's she been? You know, this is her. She hadn't won a Grand Slam match a week ago before this Wimbledon. I think she had pretty much a shoulder reconstruction very early in her career. So she's been set back a bit, but she can play.
Yeah, sure can. And I was really impressed with that performance. And I think what I thought she did really well is just not give Watson any rhythm at all. You know, Watson is a really steady baseliner. And we saw her last match against Kaya Juvan, which was brimming with lots of fun rallies. And once Watson gets her teeth into those sorts of points, she can be a tricky player to face. But Niemeyer just didn't allow her to play that style of tennis, either with her serve or her slice or her willingness to come to the net. She controlled the match. She played it on her terms, and I thought that was really impressive, as you said, especially given the first centre court experience. We saw what that did to Alcaraz, just well in the very next match, wasn't it? And Niemeyer handled it all brilliantly. And yeah, a Wimbledon quarterfinal between the world number 97 and the world number 103, both from Germany. It's incredible.
And on the other half of that half of the draw, the other quarter, you might call it, in order to be less confusing, will be Ons Jabeur against Marie Buzkova. We'll come on to talk about those two matches later. But just while we're on the draw, all due respect to Buzkova, Maria and Niemeyer. Goodness me, there will never be more of an opportunity for Ons Jabeur, will there? Or it's hard to see more of an opportunity. I mean, it's massive.
Yeah, I mean, she's massive favourite now. And I might have to put her in my mix.
Don't know what more she has to do. She won...
Win the thing.
She won ugly today and grittily. I mean, not exclusively ugly. There were good moments, but for her, it was dicey today against a totally on fire Elisa Mertens. This was a great match. 7-6, 6-4 for Jabeur. Saved 5 set points in the first set to take it 11-9 in the tie break. She, you know, it's all very well to win when it's just beautiful, lovely. Get your tool bag out and choose which shot you want to play when. This was digging to a dark place for Ons Jabeur, and I think that's quite significant. No one wins a Grand Slam without going to a place like that. So the fact that she went there and she came through today, I think, is massive for her.
Yes, I agree. It was a match which felt like both players knew that it was a massive opportunity. You know, all the other matches on that side of the draw had been played. The draw was set. Maria, Niemeyer, Buzkova were there. And especially Ons Jabeur must have realised the opportunity that presented. And it was a stressful opening set. She was up a break twice and Mertens just wouldn't let her get properly ahead and got the break back. And it did end up in this tie break. And that was the moment where, look, I've been pretty convinced by Jabeur anyway. I've put her in the mix, as I think when Świątek went out, she would be my next in line as most likely to win it. But right there in that tie break, I saw something else that just made me convinced. And that was audacious, bold, brilliant tennis when she needed it most. You know, she saved those set points. Mertens didn't lose them. Jabeur saved them. Never stopped going for her shots, especially with the forehand. Gave a huge fist pump when she did win that set. She knew the significance of it. I think it's a real test passed for Ons Jabeur today.
I think it could be one of the biggest wins of her career.
Mm,
because,
I agree.
Because, you know, that could be the moment that we look back on with her holding the trophy.
David's gone.
Well, we've been saying that for a while, David.
Sure, but that is the match that I could have seen her losing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because I was watching it out of the corner of my eye whilst commentating on something else, and it was so nip and tuck in that first set. And Hannah was tweeting on our tennis podcast Twitter and messaging us saying how stressed Ons Jabeur looked. And I'm just thinking, add that up in my head. Here's the shot maker who can do it all, but has she actually got what it takes? That's where I've always questioned her.
And I've told you, it's a different Ons now, David. Well, she's turned a corner.
If she wins this title, I will bow to you, Catherine, because...
Content.
yeah, looking forward to that photo.
I will, because Catherine has been saying this all along, and I take that.
Just logically, on the basis that until you see them do it, you won't believe they can do it. And I get that. I get that. Totally understand the logic of that. Is Simona Halep your favourite for the title? Because she's the only one left in that's even won a slam now Ostapenko's gone out.
I suppose so. I do think also Amanda Anisimova's playing really well, but then she's playing Harmony Tan, and I wonder whether that might be a banana skin for her. But yes, I think Simona Halep is the one that gives me confidence that she... Well, because she's been there and done it. I do think that that's a big factor. And she seems refreshed again. So I would probably say that she is the favourite on paper. But I am getting a feeling for Ons Jabeur based on the fact that she's in that half the draw and the way that she won this match. And everything. There's loads of other evidence as well. She's been playing brilliantly all year. This isn't a one-off. I know she had that French Open thing, but it does feel different, Catherine. I give you all that.
She's got more WTA wins than anyone else going back to the start of 2021. She overtook Iga Świątek today, 82 in total. I got that stat from a sponsored post on Twitter from Opta Ace.
Oh. Mm. 82 wins since when?
Since the start of 2021.
That is a lot of wins, isn't it?
More than Świątek.
I mean, obviously,
feels like Świątek's had 82 this year.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this year Świątek's way ahead. But yeah, I liked it. So thank you, Opta Ace.
Give them a follow.
I didn't give them a follow. She'll now face Marie Buzkova in the quarterfinals, who's amazing versus Caroline Garcia. 7-5-6-2 out on court two at the start of the day. Tell us about the backhand, Matt.
It was stunning. It was early in the second set, and she'd been defending for her life in this rally against Garcia. And Garcia had hit a backhand smash angled into the Buzkova backhand corner, and I thought the Garcia backhand smash was going to have won the point. It looked like it was about to bounce for a second time. Buzkova scrambled and not only got it back, but fired a winner. I don't quite know whether it went round the net or just over the net, but it was, you know, in that region, so low, so straight, so powerful, clean winner. It was absolutely incredible how she reached it and managed to conjure up that shot from that position. She was flawless today. Do you know how many unforced errors she hit in two sets? Four.
What?
Just four unforced errors. She had that perfect blend of going for it when she needed to, but also absorbing everything Garcia was throwing at her. I actually think playing Mertens will probably be quite good prep for Jabeur for playing Buzkova. There's a similarity there. A bit tricky, consistent.
Jabeur referenced that in press,
didn't she?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, she said glowing things about Buzkova, but she also said, at least it'll be a similar match for me.
Yeah. Okay. I'm pleased that...
That you and Ons are on the same page.
We're on the same page, yeah. That's a nice moment.
Validation. So those two quarterfinals, all the women's quarterfinals, will be played on Tuesday. So we have one more day of round four action to come before we move on to the quarterfinals. This is how what used to be Manic Monday is looking like tomorrow. Just regular old Monday.
And actually, that was the takeaway from today, wasn't it? And I think you said it, Catherine. That match between Ostapenko and Tatiana Maria on Manic Monday, that would have been a bit lost.
Totally lost.
You know, that would have been, I don't know, out on court 18 or court 12 somewhere, probably. And, okay, it was a bit lost by Cliff Richard singing all over it for the first hour or so. But the climax of the max, all eyes were on it because it was on court one. And, you know, it was just great. And I think... That right there is why it's right, really, to split it over 2 days.
Agreed. And just since Cliff's come up again, could we just give a shout out to Pam Shriver?
Oh yeah,
for rescuing some of the Cliff situation by reprising her dance role in the whole Cliff episode, because during original Cliff in what would it have been
1996.
Yeah. Pam and some other tennis players formed a sort of dance troupe during Cliff.
I think there was Gigi Fernandez in that.
Yeah.
Maybe Conchita Martinez.
Conchita Martinez as well.
My mum is a massive Cliff fan, so she will have enjoyed it.
Good. Aww. Glad people enjoyed it.
Well, there weren't many people in the stadium joining in. With the singing. That was the awkward bit.
And it was very awkward. And thank goodness for Pam, I would say.
Pam
in that moment,
saved it.
Well done,
she did.
Pam.
She brought some seriously needed energy, I would say, to that situation. So Very well done, Pam. Tomorrow's order of play features absolutely no Cliff Richard whatsoever, to my knowledge. Starting at 1:30 on Centre Court, Brandon Nakashima up against Nick Kyrgios. Interesting. First on centre is very different to last on court one.
Yeah, it is. It is. I wonder whether they've done that deliberately. If we're going to put him on centre, let's put him on before the watershed.
Different when he vibe, can't do isn't anything. It? Everyone's expecting him to win. It's just a different vibe. Bedossa against Halep. Yes, please.
That's a big yes, please.
Yeah. I hear what you're saying about Halep, David, and I agree with lots of it. But I think that's tough tomorrow, oh, Bedossa.
If Bedossa plays Bedossa her best, win that. She's definitely got a chance, I would have thought. It's, yeah.
And finally, Botik van der Zandschulp against Rafael Nadal. I've started saying Rafael Nadal when I do the orders of play, like your announcer man in Paris.
Mark Morey.
Rafael Nadal.
It's a good name, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a great name for commentary. I love it. Love it when he's about to hit a winner.
2022. Court number one tomorrow. Elena Rybakina against Petra Martic opens things up. Then Jason Kubler faces Taylor Fritz. And Amanda Anisimova and Harmony Tan are last on there. And there's singles action on court two as well. Christian Garin against Alex de Minaur and Elise Cornet against Ilya Tomljanovic. In the mixed doubles today, we lost Genus before I'd even had a chance to come up with a better name for them. Venus Williams and Jamie Murray knocked out by Johnny O'Mara and Alicia Barnett. 18-16 in the third set tiebreak. Scenes, Matt, scenes.
Such scenes, yeah. It was an incredible tiebreak. I think Venus and Jamie had 5 match points that they couldn't take. But even in defeat, it was just remarkable. There was one Venus Williams backhand up the line winner and subsequent celebration, which will stay with me. I immediately messaged Andrew, friend of the pod, biggest Venus Williams fan that I know, and he said that backhand pass and celebration will stay with him forever. He said getting to watch both Serena and Venus compete this week, even in defeat, he said nothing like it. And I shared that sentiment. That's a big takeaway from week one at Wimbledon. We saw Venus Williams and we saw Serena Williams again. Amazing.
That is really cool. And actually, funny enough, it was a year ago when I think we decided, our view was that we probably wouldn't see Serena again, and we certainly wouldn't see Roger Federer again. And here was Federer saying, I want to experience it one more time. And even if it's kind of like a bit of a going through the motions and not able to be competitive, it is worth it, isn't it? It's worth it to see these players. Like Serena had a good go in that first round. Venus had a good go in the... I'd be happy to have a good memory to take away.
If it's what they want, I'm totally happy with it. I cannot bear all this, you know, people that say they should retire and go out gracefully.
Yeah, nonsense.
Bollocks to that.
Yeah. Hear, hear.
So, bollocks to that feels like a great note to
that'll be a quote from the New York Times.
End the Day 7 podcast on, doesn't it? Yeah. Yeah, next time in the New York Times, Matt and David will have their elegant lines and I'll have Catherine Whittaker told the patriarchy to get in the bin. Bollocks to that. Willow, aren't you lucky to be our Wimbledon mascot? Hello, Willow. David, you've got Darwin. How'd you do today?
We had a win today, Darwin. Mm. Yeah. Can't remember who it was, but we did.
Cameron Norrie.
Mr. Reliable. Never lets me down.
Carter and I scored a win with Jewel and Niemeyer. Matt, dearly departed Gerald, how did you get on?
No. Carlos Alcaraz let me down. What a sentence.
Billie Jean, still chewing away on her bone. She is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss, who were obviously Billie Jean was in the Parade of Champions today, and they were in the Royal Box together, and they sat and watched all of the tennis from beginning
all of it
to end. And that was recognised by Novak Djokovic, actually, after the match. He said what it meant to him to have them watching throughout, and what a honour it was to play in front of Billie Jean. And he
said he thought he knew his tennis history until he was talking to Billie Jean King today, and he realised there's a lot more history he still needs to know.
Relatable, Novak. Mm. Relatable. I just loved that they watched it all.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Carl Weingartner and Chris Albert Lee are our executive producers and top blokes. And we've got shout outs.
We do. We have John and Leah, who are long-time supporters.
We love John and Leah. Ah.
They are from Reading and Hamburg, respectively. But
Hang on,
but
I didn't know John was from Reading.
No, nor did I until I read that today.
Why hasn't he mentioned it sooner? We could talk Reading together.
Is he a Reading fan?
Let us know, John. Whereabouts in Reading?
We need to know.
What school did you go to?
All the important stuff.
It's almost getting a bit Cameron Norrie, where do you live, weird.
It is. Let's move on.
We also have Lily Dennison, who is in Minneapolis.
All right, Lily.
Hello, Lily.
Lily says that she played college tennis and watched the professional game passively, is her word, until the US Open 2017, when she discovered the tennis podcast, and she's now obsessed with tennis as a sport.
I feel very
Hello, Lily.
Chuffed.
That's lovely.
Hmm.
I can't think of any Lilies who played tennis professionally. Can you? No. Ooh.
No, I can't.
No. Stony silence. Sorry. Mm. But thank you, Lily.
And finally, we have Chrissy Davis.
Oh, Chrissy. Perfect name.
Chrissy is in Australia, and she says she's a huge tennis and Taylor Swift fan.
Oh.
And Catherine, she wants to know your favourite Taylor Swift song.
Depends what mood I'm in.
Quite right.
How about the mood you're in right now?
Right now, well, it's 1:05 in the morning.
Generally irritated.
I'd probably go for a bit of All Too Well, 10-minute version.
Chrissy says, Taylor, my favourite is All Too Well.
Oh!
Perfect. It's all worked out.
Does she say 10-minute version, presumably?
I would have thought so.
How many versions are there?
I thought so. I'll talk you through it.
You're about to hear them all, David.
Thank you, Chrissy, for supporting the Tennis Podcast. If you would like to become a friend, the link to do so is in our show notes. You can get yourself a shout out or an intro, or just get yourself the lovely extra content that we record and make available for friends, including the Tennis Podcast. No, it's not called that. Including Tennis Relived and the two Wimbledon Relived episodes we recorded in the build up to this Wimbledon. If you want to sign up to the newsletter, do it. The link to do that is in our show notes. The stats are brilliant. It's all lovely stuff.
I mean, they really are amazing.
Tell your friends, leave us an Apple Podcast review, and make sure you join us tomorrow for Not So Manic Monday. We'll speak to you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.